Good afternoon, everyone. The time is 1:32. I'd like to call this meeting of the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. We are in Belt's Room 105 here in the Thomas Stewart Building in our state capital of Juneau, Alaska. Today is Wednesday, February 15th, 2023. Members present are Senator Merrick, Senator Gray Jackson, Senator Dunbar, and myself, Senator Bjorkman. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off or silence your cell phones. I'd like to recognize and welcome our recording secretary, Juliana Singh, and our LIO moderator, Sydney Truitt. Today, we will continue our exploration of workforce issues in Alaska from the perspective of labor unions. With us today, we have Shannon Anderson, Vice President of Masters, Mates, and Pilots, Jordan Adams, Business Manager, Public Employees, Local 71, Bronson Fry, South Central Building Trades, and Joelle Hall, the President of the AFL-CIO. First up, we have Ms. Adams. If you could join us here at the table, that would be most excellent. And when you get all settled in there, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Hello, good afternoon. My name is Shannon Adamson. I'm representing Masters, Mates, and Pilots. We represent the licensed deck officers with the Alaska Marine Highway System. But just a small correction, I actually technically retired as of August, so I'm just the most recent person to be able to give you guys some information.
Well, thank you for joining us today, Shannon. Would you like it if members of the committee asked you questions throughout your presentation, or shall we hold questions till the end?
During would be perfect. I tend to think a little bit better on my feet.
Most excellent. Very good. Please continue.
Okay, so I'm hoping that I can give you guys some perspective specifically from the maritime groups, which is myself, Masters, Mates, and Pilots, the Marine Beneficials Association, Marine Engineers Beneficial Association, which represent the engineers on the Alaska Marine Highway System, and to a certain extent, the Inland Boatmen Union, although I don't technically have the ability to speak for all three groups, just MMP. So what I think the most important thing that I want to get across, I think the best thing for everyone to understand is that because these individuals have very highly skilled and desirable licensure that is required for their positions, it makes it very easy for these individuals to transfer from their current positions with the Marine Highway System into other, in some instances, more desirable positions. So, for example, the offshore division, which works out of the Masters, Mates, and Pilots Hall, is paid somewhere in the ballpark of 40 to 60% more than what the members could make at the Alaska Marine Highway System. The Pilots Association is actually double to 2.5 times what the guys can make when they sail with the Alaska Marine Highway System. One of the biggest deterrents for retention in regards to the Marine Highway System is Tier 4, the retirement system of Tier 4, because it is mobile, and again, because these guys have licenses that make it so that they are desirable in other positions, they're wanting to stay is less of a, the retirement system is less of a hook to keep people around, I think is what I'm trying to say. And then this one is difficult to say, and I think I'm going to fumble it, so please give me a second. Because Masters, Mates, and Pilots specifically are responsible for the vessels while they're underway, and in some instances in any sort of maintenance period, the fact that deferred maintenance has become such a large issue with the Alaska Marine Highway System, our members are much more have a much more higher liability if something should happen to those vessels. So the deferred maintenance itself is actually a pretty decent retention problem for the guys that have been around or are working masters. So I'm hoping that I can offer a few solutions specific to the Marine Highway System and DOT. As weird as it's going to sound, new ships will actually be a very large recruitment and retention tool. The fact that the members are currently working on 60-year-old vessels in the oldest sense, and the average age of the vessels is actually 35, when most companies start talking about replacing their vessels when they reach 20 years old. That is going to be a huge recruitment and retention tool. Obviously, as a union rep, I've got to tell you guys better wages is actually going to make a difference. And then the last one is a better working relationship with management, which includes labor relations. Those are the things that I have prepared for you. I'm hoping you guys have some questions for me.
Thank you, Ms. Anderson. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Anderson. So could you provide a little bit more detail about the better relationship with management? You know, what are the sort of pressure points that have caused stress in the last few years that might be driving that breakdown in the relationship?
Yeah, of course. I'm sorry, through the chair, Senator Dunbar. One of the things that we're seeing as a recurring issue in regards to management and labor relations is the fact that labor relations has a lot more control over the day-to-day operation of the vessels than would be ideal. And they are trying to work within specific confines of the contract that they misinterpret during negotiations, or decisions are not being made specifically by the people that have the ability to operate the vessels. So the disconnect between management, the ships, and labor relations has been an ongoing issue as long as I was a union rep and when I still sailed. I sailed for AMHS for 7 years before I moved ashore and then became the union rep. But it was an issue when I was still sailing and I was the union rep for 10 years before I retired. It is not a new problem. However, it has been exacerbated in the last 5 years.
Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? Are there examples from other parts of the country? I mean, we've got sort of a unique marine highway system, right? And it's the number of miles traveled and the rest of it. But are there examples from other parts of the country where there have been a more positive relationship created that you know? Is there other models that we could use?
Yeah, of course. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Yes. My shining example at the moment is actually Washington State Ferries, which works because it's the one that we're most regularly committed to. Now, Washington State Ferries is a very different ferry system in that they have a much higher ridership and they're operating much shorter runs. But they had issues regarding labor relations and miscommunication between labor relations vessels and management for years. They replaced a chunk of management's positions and they realigned what they considered their communications process about 10 years ago, don't quote me on that one. And since then, the communication between the vessels and management and their DOT has all been much more streamlined. The grievance process has decreased and the amount of notice of pay problems has gone down significantly. To give credit where it's due, DOT is starting to work towards that direction. The thing that makes me the most pessimistic, although I don't like to use that word, is that the system has been driven into the ground so hard with financial issues the last 5 to 10 years that they're going to be working in a very uphill battle.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for being here. Listening to you talk about the issues, defined benefit, issues, wages, and relationship with management, all three of those causes a lot of stress with employees. And so for me, physical health is important, but so is mental health. So I'm wondering if there's any kind of provisions within the workplace dealing with the mental health of our employees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Through the chair, Senator Jackson. The short answer to your question is no, not really. The current DOT management is trying to create a better communication between the vessels and shoreside. And I think that is a great plan, and I am really hopeful that will create some positive solutions. But that is the closest we have to anything that would involve trying to help the members with their mental health in regards to stress.
Thank you. Can I follow up, Mr. Chair?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's really important to me, but I've also been selected to be on the Council of State Governments Mental Health National Task Force, and my committee is mental health in the workplace. So I'm asking that same question to a lot of folks because I think it is so important. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Are there other questions from the committee? Ms. Adamson, you mentioned that you were concerned that the Alaska Marine Highway System was facing significant challenges and clearly some cuts. And are there other things that are happening for the Marine Highway System that are damaging the ferry system's ability to fund itself the best that it could?
Yes, Chairman, there really are. I think the example that pops to my head the soonest or the quickest is 5 years ago or so, DOT management decided that they wanted to implement a dynamic pricing system. And that dynamic pricing system, although well-intentioned, I believe actually harmed the system in the long run. I sat on the Marine Transportation Advisory Board for 5 years before that board was done away with. And the Marine Transportation Advisory Board did recommend a version of dynamic pricing. The version that we recommended would have decreased prices until the vessels got to approximately 70 to 75% full and then would have increased prices. DOT's model does nothing to decrease the base price and only increases the prices in the long run. So that, I believe, has actually decreased ridership, which is decreased revenue. It also makes it difficult for a passenger to predict what their ticket is going to cost. I think these decisions, that being the best example that pops into my head, show a lack of understanding in regards to what the passengers want or need, and especially in regards to ways to increase revenue. I am of the belief that the vessels are going to run whether or not they are full, so it would be in everyone's best interest to fill the boats and to try and see if we can increase ridership more continuously in the long run, even if we have to sell tickets at a lower price initially, to try and see if we can create that connection to the communities that we used to have, and increase ridership even further in the long run.
Thank you. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So yesterday at we had a joint meeting of the Health and Social Services Committee with the House. We were meeting with OCS, and they have this tremendous turnover rate. And there was they described how deleterious that was to their ability to deliver services. And you've talked about Tier 4 and the fact that drives turnover. Can you speak a little bit about your perception of how having a high rate of turnover and having less experienced pilots and other employees, how that impacts the functioning of the Marine Highway System?
Yes, of course. Through the chair, Senator Dunbar. Yes. So right now, we have an abundance of second and third mates that have been hired recently. And that is amazing. I've got to give the state credit that the recruitment for the second and third mate positions has been amazing, and there's been a whole lot of hirings lately. The catch is that because of the way the systems run and because of Coast Guard regulations, it takes you approximately 10 years to go from a third mate to a master, and then I'd say another 3 or 4 years past that to become a very useful master, someone who actually has the experience to be able to operate these vessels, these 412-foot vessels through Wrangell Narrows. So I think the fact that we are seriously shorthanded in the higher divisions makes it extremely difficult for the system to operate relatively efficiently. It doesn't help that the people that are chief mates and masters, the higher level of those positions, are the ones that are most desirable everywhere else in the industry. So these positions, these members are choosing to work in other places. I think that's going to be seriously detrimental to the Marine Highway System in the next 2 or 3 years. I remember when I first started with the system in 2006, and now I'm dating myself, that as a master, you had to work for the system for 20 to 25 years to be able to be a permanent full-time master. We're getting to the point now where people who have been around for 15 years are becoming permanent full-time masters. And I appreciate that they're willing to stick around in a less than desirable position, but the experience that those members are missing is going to be noticed. Did that answer your question, Senator?
Yes, and just to put a finer point on it, the lack of a pension, you believe, is contributing to the fact that we are not able to keep people long term. Is that right?
Yes, and sorry, through the chair. Yes, correct. So there are members that are sticking around for their 5 years and then choosing upgrading their licenses and getting pilotage, which makes them desirable in other locations, and then taking that retirement system and going to different positions.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. For the record, I announce that Senator Bishop joined us at about 1:37. Thank you for joining us. Are there other questions?
Just like a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Please do.
Not a question, just a comment. Shannon, you know, I think it was last year there had been discussion about forward funding the Marine Highway so they could produce a schedule out for 2 years, right? So people had some continuity in scheduling, and knowing that the boat would be there for whatever vacation. Because I ran into people here, tourists, that said that their Marine Highway experience was the highlight of their Southeast trip. Right, and we did that last year, right? We put enough money in the budget so they think they go out for 2 years with a schedule. So that's going to help too, right? But only time is going to tell. But we should, hopefully we're going to see bookings go up to get those boats back to capacity that you described earlier. So, and that was an outcome of the working group.
Thank you, Ms. Adamson, for joining us today here at Senate Labor and Commerce. We appreciate you being here. Any closing thoughts?
No, thank you so much for inviting me. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Very good. We'll take a brief at ease while we change speakers. And we're back on the record at 1:48. Joining us now, we have Mr. Adams. Mr. Adams, thank you for joining us. Please state your name for the record. State your name and affiliation.
Jordan Adams, business manager for Public Employees Local 71.
Thank you. Would you like us to ask questions throughout your presentation or wait until the end?
After would be better, unless it's imperative we ask it at the time.
You bet, Jordan. Please begin.
I'm Jordan Adams, business manager for Local 71. 11 years with our local union now, and then prior to that, I did work for the state of Alaska for 7 years, so I understand, even though it was getting to be a bit farther ago. Our folks are blue-collar, essential workers, heavy equipment operators, light and heavy-duty mechanics, carpenters, electricians, building maintenance, and custodian, and everything in between. We ply almost 20,000 road miles. We also maintain 3 international airports and a bunch of rural airports, and maintain over 5,000 pieces of heavy equipment and critical infrastructure. So, for many years now, state wages have slipped further away from comparable jobs in both the public and private sector. Now, we've always pushed, and all unions have pushed, to narrow that gap. But we're backing up these numbers by studies and numbers that the state already has. The state's efforts in negotiating increases have been met with budgets that restrict the growth necessary to keep up with private industry or even just other public industry. Simply put, the state of Alaska has many classifications that are now nowhere near competitive in the market for a blue-collar worker, and we don't believe the state is showing a lot of interest in reducing that. Through the state's own guidance to the DOA under compensation concerns, the state reduced its wage target within the past year from 65th percentile to 50th percentile. Like other state contracts that are built on a graduating pay structure, the longer you're in the system, the higher earning potential that you do have. But it's kind of a limiting factor depending on your age group. If you can't be in it long enough, you'll never be here long enough to earn a wage worthy. Having to work 20 years to obtain a wage where some start today is fairly ridiculous. Reviewing other bargaining unit profiles, as well as our own, you can see the decline of longevity among state employees. The pay is paramount. It's number one. It has to be. The skills required for many of these positions are advanced duty skilled workers, and the market is extremely competitive within Alaska. Now our retirement and benefits, tier 1, 2, and 3, that worked well. Changes to the retirement system is often brought up in our halls and is needed if we're going to regain any power in recruitment and retention. 16 years under tier 4 now, so we've seen what that's looked like and the depression that we've had from hiring folks under those. That decision of retirement and what is offered in retirement is also heavily weighed when someone chooses to take a state job. And now that they're less than they were, I still have individuals that come into my hall thinking that they are going to have the retirement of their father, uncle, or brother, and those don't exist anymore. Staffing shortages, they're hurting every department, not just the workers that we have, but right over here in the SOB and probably in this building as well. when you have less people to do the job, it makes everybody else's job tougher. Snow events and emergencies are now more difficult than ever to deal with. While it's all hands on deck, the limited number of employees that we do have are being burned out. Production and safety suffer. Another note under the DOA guidelines, when there's a moderate change, like there's less employees, nobody gets paid anymore for that. That's not the kicker to get you paid more. So when there's less folks, all hands come in, we just do more with less. Recruitment hiring delays. It often takes 6-8 weeks or more to get somebody hired from the time we call them for an interview until the time they get that equipment or start working on that building. In that amount of time, everybody puts in for multiple jobs at a time, or often do. If one of those other jobs becomes available, they take those. And so we often have people exit the hiring pool even while in the process. Another thing to realize is over the past couple of years, due to budget shortfalls, we've closed different state camps. It's been detrimental to the health, life, and safety of the traveling public. Couple instances, Silvertip, Birch Lake, and we got a mining project that's getting ready to come in. Birch Lake reopened. We just reopened Central. Silvertip reopened. We have to do that for public safety. Job security. We've gotten 3 pink slips within the past 7 years. July, that's not a lot of fun when you have to send out 15,000 pink slips to these employees. The trust employees have in the state has been heavily diminished. Geodiff is another item that has been ignored for a little longer than we would like. Many communities and rural locations have substantially higher cost of living that eclipse those of the larger cities, and we've not seen a geodiff study since 2008. Under the state's own guidelines, that's supposed to be performed every 5 years. Areas that are not able to hire within their community have resorted to flying in workers from other locations, and the state has no issue paying the flights, accommodations, bed and breakfast, transportation, what have you, at exorbitant fees rather than paying the people in that community a higher wage to be there. And when that person's out of town, you can't call them in for overtime for that snowfall. Now, I was asked, what have we done to kind of combat that? Incentive pays and MCIPs, mission critical incentive plans. Those come in 2 different sizes. One is a dollar amount on your paycheck, and the other one is just a percentage added to your base wages. We've seen a lot more results with the percentage added to your base wages because then it encourages overtime, leave time, everything else that we need. We've also moved into alternating work weeks. The standard 5-day work week really doesn't exist for a lot of the work that we do. 4-day work weeks, week on, week off, 2 weeks on. There's production to be made with that, as well as those kind of have built-in overtime and schedules that pay people more money, and that's one of the tools we've used to kind of help promote some of these issues. Now, just to back up on something I missed, the Anchorage International Airport, we started a 30% incentive on Halloween. As of this Monday, we went from 35% vacancy to almost none. Now, it doesn't happen all at once, and what people were concerned with is if you offer an incentive at one location, you're just basically stealing your state resources from other camps. Well, that didn't happen. We got a lot of new employees, so that's exactly what we were looking for. In closing, the state of Alaska has a pay gap that has resulted in the inability to bring on qualified workers. With the incoming infrastructure funds, which will lead to an increase in demand of all qualified blue-collar workers from every industry. If we don't fix these issues, we may end up in some place that we can't fix. Without the workforce or public safety, we can't respond. Our airports can't function. People can't commute to their jobs, and commerce will be hampered. So I ask this to you, ask the administration what we can do to fix it before it's too late. Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan. Are there questions from members of the committee? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. So do you have any suggestions on what we can do to fix it besides dealing with the defined benefit?
Hey.
And pay increases. Okay.
I have comparable numbers. I can send everybody here, as well as some of the tools and LOAs, letters of agreement, that we've used. It strictly comes down to pay in a lot of cases. Our beginning wages are 30% or more for electricians. It may be 40% under industry standard. And that's really hurting. So pay and then benefits would be the next portion of that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in addition to pay, you know, we've obviously heard a lot about workforce development. And I'm sort of curious, particularly with snowplow drivers and the other heavy machine operators, where do most of your members get their training? You know, is it on the job? Is it your apprenticeship programs? Are there schools? You know, are there places that we could help and invest as well?
We do have limited training programs throughout the state, on-the-job training in remote locations. But the state of Alaska really expects you to show up first day on the job with all of these skills. And unlike having a CDL where you're expected just to be a truck driver, in a lot of cases we're expecting you to be nearly a jack of all trades. You load your own vehicle, you plow with it, you sand with it, and at times you have to fix it yourself.
Yeah. Can I follow up, Mr. Chair? So I'm thinking about a kid in Mountain View that ends up going to East High School, you know, and doesn't have anyone in their family that's done this kind of work before. How would they get plugged into this profession? I mean, how would they learn these skills that the state of Alaska expects them to have when they show up?
Sorry, through the chair. You can always come in at a lower level, flaggers. Yeah. That's actually considered an equipment operating position. And then we always foster our own on-the-job training. But the state of Alaska themselves doesn't really run a training apprenticeship program. They don't. We do run training programs, but it's much different than other unions you may be used to.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Mayer.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman, and Mr. Adams, thanks for being here today. You said your members do a variety of crafts. Why? Can you give me the pay and benefits difference between, say, a carpenter that's in the Carpenters Union in comparison to a carpenter in Local 71?
Yeah, an easy explanation of that is 25 to 30% under the other industries. The benefits are decent, but there's still a wage gap there. I have information that I can provide you all of the trades that we offer for a more detailed explanation of that. And we compare apples to apples, and in like communities, we don't cherry pick the best example for the worst example. It's easy to see, even amongst rural communities, 20 and 30% difference.
Thank you.
Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So you may be able to answer this question now, and if not, maybe later. So how many of your employees are in Tier 1, 2, 3, and then Tier 4, roughly?
Without guessing.
You can guess. It's okay. Yeah.
You would probably have 30, 40% still in Tier 1, 2, and 3. It's been 16 years.
Right,
and our average tenure for an employee is 8. So they're dwindling fast.
I thought so. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Adams, welcome today. Labor and Commerce, thanks for sharing with us. The chair will give me a little bit of latitude. We'll just have a little conversation here. So on your, do you do any exit surveys with your employees?
Generally, no. They quit and they're pretty quick to get out.
Okay. Yeah, right. So other than anecdotal, we don't have any hard data whether leaving.
I believe the state does an exit evaluation when they can. and that would probably be the best place for us to look for that. Okay.
So I want to go back to something you had said earlier, and you're exactly right. Five of these maintenance stations were closed in my district. So in that, since they were closed until today, I've managed to get three of them reopened: Central, Birch Lake, and Chittenden. And Senator Machicki was able to negotiate and get Silvertip back up. So moving in the right direction, but it still doesn't solve the problem. And I'm pretty in tune with Northern Region, as you well know, and I have my annual set down with DOT before I come down here every spring, January. And last year there was a 70-person gap in Northern Region for your folks, as you well know. And this January, we only moved the needle by five positions. We still have a 65% gap. And you're 100% right. I've always said, my local, you know what I do, my local operating engineers, and the pay differential is one of the main drivers, notwithstanding the pension. Something that I'll just throw out here, when I first came here as Commissioner of Labor, one of my first meetings was with DOT trying to stand and working with 71. At that time, it was Jim, I'm trying to remember the business manager's name. Jim Ashton, working with DOT, trying to get a training trust set up, and we kept running into roadblocks with the legal department over here. And I think today that's something that we should have that conversation again to get a registered apprenticeship program. I'm not throwing stones at anybody, not a hit and miss training program. I used to work with my local in the T2 program, technology transfer programming with inside DOT, where I could help train 71 blade operators around the state, especially rural Alaska. So, but to me, we should still, and I'm going to put we, I think we should take another stab at working with the administration to try to stand up a registered apprenticeship program. I'd be fully supportive of wage contract. Just the last thing I'd like to say as a question, how many letters of agreement do you have out there?
I have them all with me. You will get a copy of all of them. I believe it's over a dozen.
Okay, thank you.
Jordan, thank you very much for your testimony today. In front of the Senate Labor and Commerce, we appreciate it. We'll take a brief at ease while we change speakers. Bronson Fry. Mr. Fry, please put your name and affiliation on the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Bronson Fry. I'm the president of the South Central Alaska Building Trades Council, a group of all of the construction unions in our state.
Very good. Would you prefer that we ask you questions throughout your presentation or wait till the end?
Well, I've got five main points I'd like to hit, so maybe I'll pause after each one, and if there's any questions, we can dive into it and then kind of go from there. That works.
Very well. Please begin.
All right. Thank you, sir. So it is the position of the building and construction trades unions in our state that we do need to develop Alaska's construction workforce. But I'd like to open with a quote from the January 2023 Alaska Economic Trends magazine. This is from the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development. It says, as Alaska's economy continues to recover, the worker shortage will make filling positions, including those created by infrastructure spending, difficult to fill. An aging population and migration losses, especially of working age people, will exacerbate that shortage. Now, it's true that the Federal Infrastructure and Jobs Act, IIJA, along with other projects anticipated in oil, gas, and mining development, state and locally funded capital projects, and private commercial projects, are anticipated to create employment growth in all Alaska industries over the next decade and more. We are sincerely looking at a generational boom in construction, and that is a good thing, objectively. It's easy to sit back and just say throw money at the problem, but it begs the question, where specifically and how should that money be allocated? So when it comes to filling all the jobs needed, Alaska does need a trained resident workforce, which will require a renewed focus on these following five priorities. The first thing we need to do is address Alaska's child care crisis. I would am honored to sit here as a representative of the construction trades and tell you that child care is one of our biggest issues. It is a major contributor to labor shortages across all industries. It seems like everybody keeps asking, where are all the workers? Where are all the workers? Well, a lot of them are at home taking care of their kids. The reason for that is that there's too few providers and the cost is too high for many working families to be able to provide childcare. Childcare worker wages are too low, and we support sectoral bargaining for childcare workers. And I will note that Representative Zach Fields has a bill to help address this, and he would really be an expert to talk to on that particular thing. The other thing I would like to note is that currently the largest national conference of union construction workers is not the legislative conference. It is the Trade Women Build Nations Conference. Over 4,000 women construction workers come together annually. And so this issue of childcare is certainly pertinent because both men and women have opportunities to work in construction. That is something that's worth noting and remembering. And both men and women need their child to be cared for so that they can work. So that would be the first item I'd like to highlight. And I'll pause there in case anyone has any questions.
Senator Gray Jackson.
I don't have a question. I just want to say welcome, Brother Fry. That's an inside joke we have. I had to do it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions from the committee?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman. Ronson, good to see you. Is that tie real?
I tied it myself. Tell because it's not perfect.
right on. It's, I like it. I was guessing that.
Thank you.
I don't know. This is going on week three of people coming through and talking about workforce shortages and child care. You know, it's like at the top of everyone's agenda, and as it should be. And I'm glad you recognize that we both have single parents of both male and female, right, that need child care. So thanks for bringing that out. Just an editorial, I said that the contractor or the employer that cracks the code on this child care is going to be the one that's going to get the workforce.
Absolutely.
So.
Thank very you. Good. Please continue.
Yes, sir. So the second point, I believe, is very important. Is to adequately fund Alaska's public education system. It's probably something else you've been hearing a lot over the last few weeks. Funding has essentially been flat since 2017, and so we would encourage a per pupil increase in the contribution by at least $1,000 per student. It is no mystery that education is vital to every community and is a smart investment in our future. And I'll also add that sort of increase in the BSA can help with a boatload of deferred maintenance on our schools across the state, which is sort of a separate subject than the workforce, but boy, is it needed. And an increase in the BSA will kind of help address both of those. Is there any notes or questions or comments on the funding of the public education system?
No, I concur.
Good. This is off to a great start.
Education's up next.
Perfect. Thank you. I know Chairman Dorfman, near and dear to your heart for sure. That is tied to the third point, which is to prioritize career and technical education, or CTE. So secondary and post-secondary need quality CTE programs taught by qualified instructors so students can explore careers, gain knowledge and skills, and build Alaska. CTE also prepares students for Alaska jobs and infrastructure, resource development, and business expansion. And one thing I would just like to note is that oftentimes when there's cuts to the budget for the school system, these classes, these CTE classes, are typically electives, and so they're oftentimes the first ones that are cut. So we sort of have a problem that builds on itself. When we lack the funding, we end up cutting the classes and programs that would help get people into the trades. And we'll speak to that here a little bit as well. But I would just pause there on the note of career and technical education.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Fry. I guess my first comment is, I know, Mr. Fry, you and I are both football fans, and so CTE means something else, and I kind of hope we can find a different acronym, but that's the acronym that has become prevalent. And I'll say in my district, we have now King Technical High School, which is just a tremendous asset for the city of Anchorage, the municipality of Anchorage, rather. And I guess if you could speak a little bit to the efforts of the Building Trades Council to work with the Anchorage School District and to reach out and let kids know that there's that pathway. I know I've been to those really kind of exciting, almost like signing ceremonies. They put on the hat and all the rest of it. And can you speak to a little bit to those efforts within the school district?
Thank you. And through the chair, I will just say, Senator Dunbar, I agree with you that King Tech High School is one of the finest educational institutions in the state, in my opinion. And there is a couple of different ways that the building trades have been reaching out to the schools and school districts trying to coordinate to increase awareness about the career opportunities that a lot of these youths had. You asked a question earlier about maybe like a kid in Mountain View, how would he find out about a job in driving trucks or working in construction? That has been my experience, is that oftentimes it's not that they don't want to work or can't work, or that this generation is lazy or whatever. We get a lot of broad brush painting going on of the, let's just say, youth. I'm not so sure about that. I think that a lot of the times they just aren't aware of the opportunity that they have out in front of them. And particularly with this massive amount of work, construction work, particularly coming to Alaska, opportunity is the key. Now, you've got the traditional job fairs and things of that nature. I know that there are unions that are exploring more targeted recruitment of high school graduates, particularly when it comes to the construction trades with the athletic programs. I'm a football coach at West High on top of everything else, and so I get to have an opportunity to speak to the young men on the football team, and I think that that is not going to just be a one school type of thing. There is an or one union type of thing. We're trying to get out and find ways that we can appeal to the upcoming workforce, potential workforce in construction, and letting them know that there is opportunities to take care of their families, which is actually a big driving force for these young men. A lot of times if you ask a kid, why does he play a sport, the coach is always like, what's your why, right? Well, it's a study. How many of them say, to find my family, take care of my family? These are, teenagers. Well, this is a way they can take care of their family. There's going to be opportunities not just to learn a trade or to work, but opportunities for leadership, to be a foreman, to be a superintendent, what have you. So letting them know that there is that opportunity out there is a key part of it. It's something that I think collectively overall the building trades understands it needs to get into the schools and really, ratchet this up, because we do have such a need for workers. But I think that once broadly the youth in our community, in our state, realize the opportunity that they have, we're going to start to see an increase in application, hopefully attract and retain, a lot of the workers that we need. Thanks. Even if they didn't hear from it from their dad or their relative or what have you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you, Mr. Fry, for being here. My question relates a little bit to Senator Dunbar in that if a student goes to, say, King Career Tech, can any of the experience they gain there be used towards hours in an apprenticeship program?
Through the chair, thank you, Senator Merrick. That's a great question. Each apprenticeship, federally registered apprenticeship program has its own set of standards, and I know that that could be allowed. It would be something that each particular trade would need to address and probably should address if it hasn't already. But that could be done, I will say that.
Thank you.
Yes. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. You invited me to this party, so and I'm just so excited that you're here, Bronson. So I fixed acronym problem.
Well, good.
I'm going to go back to my generation. It was vocational education, so you can scratch the CTE and we'll just call it voc ed, so we won't get confused on your football terminology. I want to say that the workforce shortage is not all, it's not all on labor and the JATCs. Our contractors that are listening, and I've had these conversations with them for 20 years when I was fortunate to administer our training trust. There's a ratio in your contracts and your CBAs, apprentices to journey persons on the project. And we all, both contractors and employers, need to adhere to that ratio as much as we can. And I spoke about that today. Senator Merrick and I was in another meeting at finance with DOT. So on your BSA increase, you had talked about the BSA increase and VOCAD seems to fall by the wayside sometimes when and these shortfalls. I'll just leave this with you, with everyone. My information is dated, but it was accurate at the time. 75% of these high school seniors that graduate, myself included, we needed to go out and learn a trade. And 25% of those seniors that graduate need to go to four-year degree or higher. So if we're looking for a metric where to put our funding, data shows where the metric is and where the data and where the funding needs to go, my opinion. So thank you.
Very good.
Through the chair, if I may.
Absolutely.
Speak to the apprenticeship ratio. So there's two ways to look at apprenticeship ratios. One is how many journey persons you have or before you can have an apprentice. So when I started, you could only have an apprentice, one for every three journey level workers. The maximum allowable by the federal government is 1-to-1. You don't want more apprentices than journey level workers for obvious reasons. One of the challenges over the years has been to encourage employers to utilize apprentices. For a variety of reasons, some have been hesitant to do so. That has shifted, at least in the contract negotiations that I've been part of over the years. And we actually had a management proposal at our last contract negotiation that said, we want to have a clause in here that says you have to have apprentices at a certain point. And we changed it to allow for 1-to-1 a long time ago. Now we've got language that says you've got to have an apprentice after so many journey level workers. I've shared that with my counterparts, union reps in the other parts of the country, and they're flabbergasted. Usually they're pounding the table in negotiations asking for some sort of commitment or something that would compel employers to utilize apprentices. And to hear that we have management in Alaska that kind of sees the light on this was a big deal to them. So I think that you're right. It should be noted that there are ratios that can be utilized, but it's still ultimately up to the employer to call for that apprentice and recognize that they, you know, need to start training the workforce of the future. One quick note I would add about the youth that are coming out of school, a recent something I read recently indicated that 78% of high school graduates have not heard of apprenticeship programs or, you know, the opportunities in the building trades. So that sort of shows collectively the work that we all need to do in just educating these youth about the opportunities they have. And that's also why I'm not so quick to say this is a bunch of lazy kids that don't want to work. I don't believe that's necessarily the case. I think they, well, obviously, numbers tell you. Almost 80% of them never even heard of the opportunity. So sort of on us collectively. But we're working on it, and that's kind of the obvious need is there.
Senator Bishop.
So, Bronson, one of the things I used to do, and I apologize. I know I'm an old man and sound like my dad, but
sound like my dad, too.
You know, the book of Proverbs says a wise man seeks a large counsel. So, what I used to do, because there's not enough career counselors in the high schools. Sure. There isn't, right? And you can't expect two counselors for 1,200 students to get the message out. So what did we do when back in my day when I was in the JATC movement? And we started doing boot camps for teachers at our JATCs.
Wow.
Okay? And send a letter out to every school district in my region and come to RJATC, spend a day, a couple days with us. I can't remember. I think it was a three-day intensive boot camp for any teacher that wanted to come, because those teachers are in with those students every day, right? And they could be – I'm trying to make another counselor, so to speak, right, to get that message out. So that, and just to dovetail on Senator Merrick's question a little earlier, Senator Merrick, Bronson is 100% right. Every JETC has their own terms and conditions, if you will, on what's allowable for entry, direct entry, et cetera, in the apprenticeship programs. But I'd like to say that myself and my Curtis Hall, my former administrator that I worked with, we started the first ever school to registered apprenticeship program, where those juniors and seniors, those classroom hours at King Career Center would contribute to your 6,000 hour JETC time frame. So there's not a lot of, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Sometimes we just got to have a little bit of a refresher and go back and pick up on some of those good ideas that maybe for whatever reason have fallen by the wayside, so to speak. So
please continue.
Yes, sir. So two more points here, and these are key. So an increased investment in state job training programs. An increase to the State Training and Employment Program, or STEP, to increase job training, expand apprenticeship, and strengthen resident hire in all regions of the state. These STEP grants, I think should be noted, are budget neutral, because the money comes out of the unemployment insurance taxes that are withheld by the state. So increasing that STEP grant is something I would encourage to put high on the list. In addition to that, increasing the Alaska Construction Academy's funding to provide more Alaskans with basic skills and pre-apprenticeship training for construction trade occupations for multiple industries: construction, oil and gas, mining, maritime, and surface transportation. And these construction academies would be another excellent vehicle, speaking to Senator Dunbar's question about how do youths get the opportunity to learn the basic skills of a particular craft or trade. There are a variety of these Alaska Construction Academies ran by different organizations around the state: Juneau, Ketchikan, Anchorage, Fairbanks, Mat-Su, and they are excellent. About approximately 40 hours, they teach kids basic skills on everything from drywall finishing. I know, because I taught one at KCC, or formerly known as KCC, now King Tech, electrical, plumbing, carpentry, and what have you. So that funding for increasing both the STEP grant and the construction academies would be something I would very much like to highlight. And I'll pause there, Chair. Thank you. Anybody?
Please. Okay. Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Since we're talking about King Career Center, it's a fabulous facility.
Absolutely.
There's only one thing wrong with it. It's too small. You need another one in South Anchorage. And I identified that in 2010 and even spoke to that in this building when I used to be here in another capacity.
Well, and through the chair, I would offer that maybe even one outside of Anchorage would be appropriate. We could have another one in Anchorage. That would be great. And there's other places in the state where a similar type of school focused on vocational education was available to kids to go to.
Please continue.
Thank you, sir. So my last point is rural apprenticeship outreach and career awareness. So we have a lot of jobs coming, and if you have an opportunity to go look at Senator Lisa Murkowski's website, she's got a map of the state of Alaska with a little red dot where all of the jobs are going to be located. Someone commented to me that it looked like the state had chicken pox. There's red dots everywhere. It is covered. And what that tells us is obvious, that the majority of construction that's coming is going to be outside of our two big urban areas in Anchorage and Fairbanks. So rural apprenticeship outreach and career awareness is got to be a key component of what is being considered. Now, I believe strongly that the registered apprenticeship model is demonstrably the best way to train a safe and skilled and efficient construction workforce. And that is a particularly unique need in rural Alaska. The registered apprenticeship model can train the workers we need not only to build the infrastructure in all of these areas around our state, but to maintain it. We're going to have a massive deep water port in Nome. That is going to be a nice big construction project. But there's going to be a whole lot of people that are going to stay there after that port's done just to maintain and run the thing. That's just one example of many across the state. So we have an advantage in that we have vehicles in our state that can help accomplish this task. The Alaska Works Partnership is one that has been around for a long time. I'm honored to serve on the board of the Alaska Works Partnership. They have an excellent track record of outreach and training of putting Alaskans to work in rural Alaska and everywhere else. So I would summarize just the last 2 points by saying an increase in STEP grant money and the Alaska Construction Academies helps this process statewide, particularly in rural Alaska, where it's going to be so needed. And I will pause there. Thank you, Chair.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Bronson. We're thankful that you're here.
Yes, sir. It is an honor. Workforce development efforts now will ensure that Alaska develops and maintains a skilled and ready resident workforce now and into the future. Thank you very much for your time and consideration.
Very good. We'll take a brief at ease while we bring up our last speaker. We're back on the record at 2:32. Joining us now, President of AFL-CIO, Joelle Hall. Ms. Hall, please state your name and affiliation for the record.
Chair Bjorkman and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak with you this afternoon. And for the record, my name is Joelle Hall. I'm the president of the Alaska AFL-CIO. The Alaska AFL-CIO is a federation of over 50 unions working in private and public sectors in jobs from ramp agents at the airport, construction workers, fish and game biologists, to bus drivers, educators, and grocery store workers. Our members' unions represent nearly 20% of the Alaska workforce. So every day, our members face the challenges this committee is here to discuss. As you know, workforce challenges are across the board, public sector, private sector, and nationwide. So we're going to need to have a plan to solve our own problems, Nobody's coming, as it has in the past, to take our jobs or to save us from ourselves. But this is a problem we must take on ourselves and figure out how to fix. The last 7 or 8 years, we've seen the out-migration of working-age adults. This is the first layer of our problem. We have to keep what we've got, and we've got to figure out how to keep ourselves here and then figure out how to attract more. The government certainly has a big role in what we can do here, and that's what I'd like to discuss here today. What can we do, and what can you control? Number one, I think it's the rollout of the capital expenditure plan, working with the congressional delegation. The rollout of money and the line of sight on construction that the industry can see for 1, 2, 3, or 4 decades in a row is the intelligence they need in order to plan out their apprenticeship modeling and to build out their apprenticeship models. Employers need to know that the jobs are on the horizon that they're going to plan to bid on so that they can plan for the future. This is not something we've done historically as a state, but as we roll out the capital budget, as we look at the matching funds for IJA dollars, it would be great if we could be working with the congressional delegation to understand as much as possible what is in the future tranches. What does that look like? So that our contractors can get a line of sight on what's coming in the future and plan the workforce accordingly. The amount of money we put towards workforce development, we've mentioned it earlier today, and I'm going to echo some of the comments made by Brother Fry just a second ago. And I will add to that the University of Alaska, because I'm going to talk a little bit about some other types of workforce that are constrained by University of Alaska investment. the benefits for state employees to help us retain workers. We've heard about it a lot today. I know you guys hear about it every day. It's clearly a factor. It's benefits, it's pay, it's working conditions. It's all of those things are critical to retaining state workers. We need to pass policies that retain Alaskans. We've talked about the pension as a system that currently has no incentive to retain Alaskans. It has the opposite incentive. I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. And Bronson, we were talking a little bit earlier about apprenticeship utilization, but there is actually a piece of public policy that this body and the other body could pass, and that's apprenticeship utilization standards on state construction. We haven't had that in a while. We have it at the municipality of Anchorage, at the school district level. If you want to train your future workforce, you got to make sure they're on the jobs, and you got to make sure that the state of Alaska is putting its money where its mouth is. You build a building, you have Alaskans, young and experienced, and new Alaskans building our investment. Apprenticeship utilization is a great decision that works union and non-union, but it definitely can help give the opportunity for those employers, because Bronson mentioned it a little bit. You take the job, you know you got to bring apprentices. There's no reluctance involved. It's a great opportunity to train people. So we talked about this earlier. There's a lot of money coming this way. The IJA dollars and the state match, our own capital budgets, broadband, the prospective natural gas pipeline, Port of Nome, Port of Alaska. This is all great opportunity for us to build Alaska and to have jobs, a generational change. 10 years of work is what we're looking at. And that is enough time to train many years of apprentices if we can kind of get a line of sight of how it's going to roll out. We need, of course, the match funds appropriated by the finance committees to make sure that these jobs come to Alaska, because just because they got sent down in the IJA bucket doesn't mean if there's no state or local match, we won't get those funds. And I want to thank people in this room who have been very, very involved in making sure that those match dollars came through last year. This is a critical piece. And we have gotten some money that didn't have match, but those were rare and far between last year. So the rest of this money is going to require a commitment to make sure that every dollar that gets brought home by the congressional delegation, that we find a dime for that dollar. Seeing what is coming allows our employers to plan, but in particular, it allows our apprenticeship systems to look forward to the work and decide how many apprentices to take into classes. It's a little bit of an art and a science mix, right? How many apprentices will you need? It's a little bit of a guessing game to figure out how many are you going to need, because you don't want people to want to train people. We don't train people to have them send them on their merry way and have them sit on the books for 6 months or a year. We don't do that. We train to go to work. So the more we know, the faster and the easier it will be for us to train. So to do that, we also need a solid workforce development plan from the Department of Labor. It needs to be updated. I'm sure that you will ask the new commissioner when she comes before you what the AWIB is up to, and then what are they looking at? Are they integrating the broadband plan? Are they integrating the workforce plan? These things are really helpful for you guys to see the long run of all the workforce needs in the state, because it will be more than just construction. It will be everything. We need, Bronson mentioned earlier, we need more money in the workforce development pipeline. He mentioned the funding streams for STEP and TDEP, and I think those are really important. We need to maximize those funding streams. We need more money into registered apprenticeship, into technical and vocational training. And to also echo what he said just a minute ago, Alaska Works Partnership is that tool that allows us to go into communities all over the state of Alaska, connect with people who want to come into the trades, and get them pre-apprenticeship kind of training to figure out what they want to do. We can do this in rural Alaska through the rural regional training centers. In the early 2000s, when our capital budgets were $2, $3, and $4 billion alone, Alaska Works Partnership was a really big part of making sure we can find that workforce from all over Alaska. It has the ability to scale back up and to do the very things we've been talking about, going to high schools, talking to the kids, doing the work. They're the perfect tool to go out and talk to the young people to get them interested in these and careers. And they also run Helmets to Hard Hats and they're involved in prisoner retraining. There's a lot of people that we can be talking to bring them into the trades, and Alaska Works Partnership runs that nexus. Young people, veterans who are leaving service, as well as people leaving incarceration who would be very welcome in almost all of our apprenticeships. In addition, this is a little bit of a, maybe a little bit of a Hail Mary. There is a lot of money rolling through in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. There was supposed to be a batch of workforce dollars coming through in the Build Back Better bill that got vetoed and or got cut. And so therefore the workforce dollars have not followed, which should have followed this epic level of investment. We need to be talking to the congressional delegation about how, if we can't get it on the next tranche of investment, how can we be flexible with these Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, because we need more workforce dollars into the state of Alaska. You flood the zone with $2 billion worth of work and there's no workforce dollars to follow it, that is not really a tenable situation. So I would urge folks in the legislature to reach out to the congressional delegation to figure out what are the creative ways that we can get workforce dollars, either a piece of what's already come, a piece of what's coming. We just need to have a conversation. They cannot possibly expect us to respond to this much money with no other federal workforce dollars to roll through. So I think it's a conversation that we should be having with the congressional delegation. We also, this is a moment in time to kind of look at architectural level about the systems we use to design, to provide training to Alaskans. Union apprenticeship is a part, hang on, let me back up, I got in the wrong spot. I firmly believe that apprenticeship is an underutilized method for training workers in the modern world, and we need to change that. Union apprenticeship is a partnership between the current workers through their union and the employers that hire those workers, the apprentices. This system is a private sector training model that responds to supply and demand seamlessly. We need more employers outside of construction industry to take the role, their role in training their own workforce. Apprenticeship is a model that's been used for millennia, but it takes a commitment from the employers to put their money where their mouth is. Sitting around waiting for employees to make it through a training system that are expensive and after which there's no direct connection to a job isn't always working. University training is essential to some. Some jobs in our state simply must rely on state services, namely the university, to produce the workers needed. For example, teachers, engineers, nurses, and architects. But to put it bluntly, those workers and employers are at the mercy of the people, and the employers and workers are at the mercy of the people in the building. The swings of the budget affect the ability of any of these training systems to respond to the needs of the workplace. Lower state budgets, lower contributions to the University of Alaska system all result in fewer people being trained to fill jobs that we need. Instead of threatening scholarships that keep our students in the state, we should be increasing them, offering more classes, scholarships, and opportunities in critical industries. We've heard a great deal about the shortages in healthcare. The pandemic has devastated an already burdened workforce, and let's be honest, shortages across the nation have been projected for years. The issue here is there is a disconnect between the employers and the training system. The pathway to many jobs in a hospital involves a university-level training. Why are we not putting enough people through the university system to meet the demand? We know why. We haven't invested in the university to meet this demand, to create this workforce. They're trapped by this lack of investment. Money gets tight, we reduce those deficits, and the employers on the other end of this system are stuck. But what if it could be different? What if the employers could be, in part, in control of their supply of workers? Joint apprenticeship training programs, which are the standard in the construction industry, serve as a model of how these employers could be helping to solve the problems they face. Workforce shortages are real, and it is nationwide in nearly every industry. It's tempting to do almost anything to solve this problem, but I want to caution you that some solutions could have unintended consequences. 20 years ago, The state faced a challenge when the actuar malfeasance in the pension system was discovered. At the time, we urged the legislature not to throw the baby out with the bathwater by dismantling the entire DB's retirement system as a response to that problem. We warned folks in 2005 that the removal of these benefits would result in people leaving the state, and the constant churn of workers would cost the state money each year. We believe the choice to respond to a temporary problem with a permanent negative solution for Alaska workers would come back to haunt us. In 2023, we were finally acknowledging that's exactly what happened. The adoption of the nurse licensing compacture is a similar of a reaction to a real but manageable problem. There are healthcare shortages everywhere. There is no giant pool of nurses waiting to come here. The gap between what we have and what we need can only be addressed through innovative thinking about how to modify the training systems for hospitals, and only if the employers themselves work together to build apprenticeship systems. These are long-term investments that will provide systematic improvements. This worker shortage has been projected for decades. We have to have a different strategy to supply this workforce. In the short term, solutions to this, the compacture of problems at the Department of Commerce should be pursued to improve the timeliness of getting nurse licenses. Here's a list of ideas that would help. One, implement a three-year cycle on renewals versus a two-year cycle and stagger them based on birth dates versus having them all expire on the same calendar basis. Every nurse in this state's license expires in December every other year. Every single one. Every November, they all have to submit their paperwork. The workload it creates is, that's an irrational way to manage a workload. So we would suggest that we should have expiration or your licensure be due on your birth date, right? So it's spread out across the year. Two, hire more licensing staff and provide a competitive wage. We've heard that over and over again. The revenues have grown 65% in the last year. Last 6 years, while the personal services line for the same period has increased 7%. Three, pursue and use more 3- and 6-month temporary licensing similar to what happened during COVID. Nurses from other states with licenses in good standing could start the licensing process in Alaska, but begin working sooner while obtaining their Alaska nurse license. With the retirement issue in place for nearly 20 years, we've come to become the training ground for other communities and states, and nurse licensing will have the same result. Our investment in nurse programs with no protection for our workforce will result in skilled nurses leaving with the training we helped provide. I suggest that that's the exact opposite of what the state should do. To meet this goal, this industry and others should look to the apprenticeship model, take control of their labor pipeline, and the state should start investing in larger classes, scholarship, child care for students in the nursing school, all in return for a commitment to stay in Alaska. We used to do that kind of thing back in the olden days when we really wanted people to stay here. We need to find ways to dissuade people from leaving Alaska, not passing public policy whose stated purpose is to make it easier for this investment to get up and leave. We have already seen this play out with retirement. To recap, we need more investment in proven models like Alaska Works Partnership, STEP, TVEP. We also need to protect school counselors. We've talked about them today. I think that they're often the front line, the first people. Classroom teachers are precious, and we need them all. But we also have to have a workforce, and school is a part of the workforce pipeline, and we need counselors who can tell people how to move on to get those jobs. We need a thoughtful workforce plan for the Department of Labor. We need to focus on creating apprenticeship programs to work around the log jams we currently face. We need apprenticeship utilization requirements to help build our future workforce. And we need Alaska solutions that address the short-term occupational licensing problems versus adopting one-size-fits-all solutions, which create unintended consequences. Thank you for your time today, and of course, I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Mm-hmm. Are there questions from the committee? Senator Gray Jackson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your presentation. I would just like to know a little bit more about Alaska Works Partnership, and I'm going to look it up, but if you can just tell me a little bit more before I look it up, that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
They're a nonprofit in Mountain View, and they run a variety of programs, which is the Alaska Construction Academy. They're also the Alaska nonprofit that houses Helmets to Hard Hats, Prisoner Reentry, and a bunch of other programs. But one of the things they are probably most famous for is running the construction academies and working with pre-apprenticeship. So if you want to get into the apprenticeship, but let's say you really like to be an electrician, but your math isn't quite ready to be an electrician, they can offer you classes to get your math up to score so that when you go to take the test, you go to interview, you have the skills needed to get to the level of being interviewed at the apprenticeship. So they do pre-apprenticeship work, they do construction academies, and they're in the schools, they present. You should get a tour, Senator. I think you would really enjoy it. And they have the ability to, they have relationships already with the regional training centers, NACTEC, Ute in Bethel, and Illisavik in Ukiavik. They have relationships already so that when we have the ability and we need training out in rural Alaska, they can take training and pre-apprenticeship out there if they don't already have that. I did go to Nome for the Workforce Development Conference, and that this kind of way that we're going to need to both train in town and bring people to town to meet the demands of such a gigantic workforce challenge as the Port of Nome. We've already begun to have those conversations. It was a wonderful meeting put on by AFL-CIO University Denali Commission. We have great opportunities in Nome, and it's a massive opportunity to get a lot of young people from all over Northwest Alaska into the construction trades. And Alaska Works Partner will be our partner with that.
Thank you for that, and I will get a tour for sure. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have two rather large and sort of unrelated questions, and I'm actually not sure if you're the right one to ask it or someone from the administration, but two separate issues you raised. One related to apprenticeships in other industries, particularly the medical field, and I've felt that way for a long time, particularly when it comes to nurses and CNAs and that kind of thing. Why isn't there more of an apprenticeship model? I guess my question is, are there other parts of the country we know of where that has been set up, or is it just the kind of structural change that is difficult to do just here in Alaska? And then my second question is, you know, when you were talking about all this money flowing in through the Bipartisan Infrastructure Fund and other federal sources, I'm wondering, is there some way to kind of to slow roll some of it? I mean, usually we try to get as much money as fast as possible, get boots on the ground, but this is 10 years, maybe longer. Is there some way to secure the funds, but then delay implementation so that we can build the workforce, or just, you know, finish a project and then start another project? Do you have any thoughts on that?
On the second one first, I don't know whether it will be an action that slows things down or whether it'll be a reaction to the inability to spend things fast enough with the cost of materials and access to labor. Right? So I do think ultimately, if there was a contract that's going to get let that they wanted to have this work completed in 3 or 4 years, I think because we're having this problem nationwide, ultimately I think some of these contracts will open up and they'll extend out. Projects will take longer than they envisioned in the original act. The idea of rolling it out slower, it would be a great conversation to have with the congressional delegation. I have to admit, it was something I was like, oh my gosh, it's so much money coming at one time, and we overheat the economy, and it's just so much better if it rolls out in a manageable amount, ideally regionally rational ways. I mean, how many times do you want to bring a front-end loader to Nome? You know, there's logistical things that also involve the way these projects can stack on each other. And it's nobody's job to stack these projects up and try to figure out how to make sense of how you run them in an order. But that seems like something that would be really a smart thing to do. I don't know whose job that is, but it seems like a really clever thing for somebody to think about doing. And then remind me what your first question was.
Trying to change the medical industry to be more of an apprenticeship model.
We recently signed on to a letter with Primary Care Associates to do an apprenticeship, a registered apprenticeship with surgery techs, med techs, lab techs, and a lot of apprenticeable skills that are sub-baccalaureate level groups. Now, this was, I don't mean this in no respect, this is exactly what should happen. This is largely made possible by a federal grant to create this apprenticeship system. The apprenticeship systems in construction are employee and employer funded. So my question is, if you are a workforce whose workflow and workers are constrained by state vestments, it seems like you might need to band together to try to solve your own problems. You're in competition with one another, so is every electrical contractor. And yet they band together to share in this resource that they know they need, and they need a predictable source of it, and they want it trained to a standard. I know that we can do apprenticeship for sub-baccalaureate level activity, and I think that is, it's about writing a standard, setting it out, and finding the money and the group of employers who invest. Because employers need to be investing in their own training. Somehow this kind of got cattywampus in the last 30 or 40 years, where employers used to train people on the job. I mean, the conversation about the state of Alaska not having really a way to train people is a classic example of, well, how can that actually be, right? How can that actually be the case? That 40 or 50 years ago, that wouldn't have been the case. So it is about going back to old things and trying to figure out how to train people on the job with us, with the some time in the, certainly some classroom time. But I think we're going to have to be very innovative. And the way we're doing it now, the constraints of the general fund that constrain our workforce, I mean, we're beyond being on the horns of a dilemma, right? That is a true existential problem for us as a state. So we're going to have to be really creative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Chair Bjorkman. Thank you, Ms. Hall, for being here. I just want to make sure that I heard you correctly. Did you say that the apprenticeship utilization requirements would benefit both union and non-union contractors? And if I did hear you correctly, can you explain to me how?
Yes, I can. Because apprenticeship is not something that is 100% the purview of union contractors. We do it as a matter of course, because it's how we train our folks. But there are non-union contractors who utilize apprentices as well.
Thank you.
Other questions? Ms. Hall, thank you very much for
joining
us.
Thank you, Senator. We really appreciate the opportunity to be before you today.
Absolutely. Thank you all for joining us today at Senate Labor and Commerce. The committee will meet again on Friday, February 17th, when we will hear from Nils Andreasen with AML. Also, we will be hearing Senate Bill 55. As there are no further business before this committee, we are adjourned at 2:59 p.m.